Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Thank you very much for being here. Today, we have two bills for public hearing only, Senate Bill 496 as well as Senate Bill 505. Because they are very similar in content, we will be opening both public hearings so we can take testimony from those who are here on both or either of the two bills. We do have a number of individuals that have signed up for today's hearing. So we are requesting that you limit your comments. I understand that organizers for the proponents have talked to their various witnesses, so please try to respect the time that we have, because I want to try to get as much, if not all, of the testimony in today from all those who have signed up for today's hearing. So with that, Whitney, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview of both the two bills.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky.
Let me do this. I'm opening up the public hearing on Senate Bill 496 as well as Senate Bill 505. Sorry, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Prezonsky. Members of the committee, we're here on Senate Bill 496 and Senate Bill 505. Senate Bill 496 requires grand jury proceedings to be recorded and provides for a phase-in of the recording requirement. It also specifies what matters within the grand jury proceeding are subject to recording and creates procedures for the release of these recordings. It does allow for a motion requesting a protective order of the grand jury recordings. Senate Bill 496 would also permit a police officer to present certain hearsay statements to the grand jury, such as statements made by a minor victim. Finally, Senate Bill 496 prohibits the release of these grand jury proceedings as a public record. Senate Bill 505 is fairly similar to Senate Bill 496, except it requires the district attorney to ensure the grand jury proceedings are recorded and allows for delegation of the recording requirement to a grand juror, shorthand reporter, or other person. Both bills have a dash one amendment. Those amendments are also fairly identical. The amendment makes several changes, including directing the court to appoint a certified shorthand reporter to take accurate notes of the grand jury proceedings. It also requires a showing of particularized need for the release of the grand jury proceeding reports and limits the use of the grand jury report in unrelated proceedings. Finally, it allows a peace officer to relate hearsay statements of a victim or witness in grand jury proceedings subject to these reporting provisions. And both bills have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right, thank you. So our first panel are legislators who are, I think, present or are supposed to be here. So let me just call out. There she is, Representative Williamson, Representative Wilson, and Senator Cruz. If you three will come up, and Senator Manning, I know that you're also giving testimony. We'll let you do that from the dais. Good morning to all, and whoever would like to start off, would please do so.
Good morning, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative for House District 36. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 496. After years of high-profile court cases and police actions, faith in the criminal justice system is at an all-time low. In Gallup, they do yearly polling of confidence in government institutions, and 23% of people say that they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the criminal justice system. Compare that to 36% of respondents who say they have very little or no confidence in the criminal justice system. For Oregon, the process to ensure equity and equality in the law and to uphold the most basic tenets of the criminal justice system, we must start with transparency. Nationwide, we are one of just two states that rely on handwritten notes from grand jurors instead of a verbatim recording as the official record of a grand jury proceeding. This leads to inaccurate record keeping and provides no evidence that the grand jury hearing was conducted fairly or properly. This bill requires an audio recording by the clerk of the court, an impartial party to the proceeding. It also specifies matters that can and cannot be recorded. It creates procedures for releasing a grand jury recording, as well as a process for the prosecuting attorney to prohibit or restrict access to the recording. It specifies when a recording, report, or transcript may be used in court proceedings. This bill also continues to provide privacy to witnesses and victims and confidentiality for grand jurors by prohibiting the release of the recording as a public record. Secrecy is not and never should be an excuse for inaccuracy or incomplete records. For the sake of improving trust and transparency within our criminal justice system and moving Oregon closer to the national norm, I urge you to vote aye on Senate Bill 496. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you can stay for questions, I'd like to get everyone on the panel, and then we can ask. All right, so Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Thatcher. Good to see you back with your nameplate again. Concerned me for a few moments. For the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. Coming to support this is not a decision that I arrived at quickly. I've taken a rather slow process to undertake the issue of grand jury recording, given a lot of thought and a lot of careful consideration. I first came to understand that grand juries in Oregon were not being recorded by talking with constituents who practice law in Grants Pass, people I've known for quite some time. In listening to them, I've come to realize how difficult it is for them to advise their clients on the strength or weakness of the government's case against them when they do not know what the state's witnesses have said under oath before the grand jury. It readily became apparent to me how much the dynamic affects the plea negotiations with district attorneys. Also, by being a longtime resident of Grants Pass and Josephine County, I came to understand that Josephine County, regrettably, was a prime example of a long-term systemic grand jury abuse. In 2001, it came to light that for more than 10 years, the district attorney's office was presenting to the grand jury witnesses who gave unsworn testimony to, for lack of a better word, indoctrinate the grand jury at the beginning of each new jury term. I was amazed to realize that this improper practice could have gone on for 10 years and no one had known about it. Not the defense bar, certainly not the courts. They were not even able to detect that practice. It was quite a story in my area for quite some time. It caused me to realize just how much our grand jury procedures in Oregon are shrouded indeed in secrecy and how they are lacking in oversight and accountability. I've listened to the testimony of prior hearings. I've done a tremendous amount of research on this and talked to a number of people, including some retiring members of this body who have gone on. I've become convinced that recordation is an important and a necessary step for the state to undertake, and I do support this concept, and I urge you to do that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. This is not a new issue for me. We've been dealing with this for several years now. When I actually sat up at that dais, we thought we had it about 2 years ago. And by the way, of the two bills you have, Mr. Chair, 496 is the one that I most enthusiastically support because I like the court being the third-party arbiter of the records, because any petition for disclosure has to go through them anyway. So I think it makes it a lot clearer. Ms. Chair, this isn't in any way a condemnation of the grand jury or the grand jury process. All this is quite simply making it to where it's not a total secret anymore. There are plenty of provisions in this legislation to protect information, to protect witnesses, including the ability with juveniles to have hearsay evidence, which, I mean, Ms. Chair, you know very well that we have gone over this with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that we have the openness we need and the protection we need as well. It's interesting that we are one of only two states that haven't gone down this road, and it's time that we caught up with the rest of the nation as far as the way we deal with grand jury and grand jury testimony. Quite honestly, we talk all the time about openness and transparency. This is openness, but guarded openness, and I think we have looked at the way other states have done this, and I think we have landed in a very good and very secure place with Senate Bill 496. So I would agree with my colleagues. We have been working on this for a long time, and it is time that we move forward. Now, I understand the big issue is probably going to be how we pay for it. So I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that we get this to Ways and Means as soon as possible so it can be added into the mix as we're trying to figure out the budget.
All right, thank you. And Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that my legislative colleagues have said it all. I mean, they've taken all my thunder, every point that I was going to raise, they already covered that. So I'm not going to take up a lot of time except to concur with them and urge that we continue on with for this to Ways and Means in order to figure out how we're going to finance this. I think that's the most important issue that I have been getting feedback from district attorneys across the state. So, you know, how do we fund this? And then how do we store the data? And who's going to be the gatekeeper for the data? So I think that those things are very important. But I do agree that this is very important, and we have a chance here to move forward. Oregon has been leading the country in a lot of ways, and I hate being on the tail end of things. So. I urge an aye vote. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel or for Senator Manning?
If I could, one additional. The reason I'm supporting the 496, number one, I'm not casting aspersions on district attorneys in any way, shape, or form, but I do think having the record with the court is they're the third party. They're the ones that have to deal with the motions anyway. I mean, if we're wanting this thing to look the way we want it to, that's the appropriate place for the record to be kept. And so I know, Mr. Chair, you're talking about sending both bills to Ways and Means, but I just wanted on the record that I think 496 is the most appropriate approach to deal with this issue.
Yeah. Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, was I supposed to go on a record and introduce myself?
I think we got you.
Okay.
We got you covered. All right. So thank you all very much. Is there any, Senator Lithicum?
Just a question. Are you aware of the Dash 1, and do you have any objections? All three of you can answer if you care to.
I haven't seen it.
The Dash 1s are pretty much what has come before as to the alternative as to changing the actual process of how the grand jury works and what type of evidence would be allowed. I will be very frank now that this has come up. I've looked at the relating clause of the bill that we have. And I have concerns as to whether the Dash 1s or all of the portions of the Dash 1s would actually be acceptable under the relating clause that we have, because the relating clause is dealing with the recordation of grand jury. My understanding, based on the review and what I've skimmed over, it does in fact actually change the process and what and how testimony would come in, not the recordation. So I think the Dash 1s are going to need to be reviewed by legislative council to determine whether or not what is included will in fact fit within our relating clause. And so we'll have a little bit additional work on that.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Senator Lithicum. Senator, having worked on this bill now for several years, my intent has always been to record the process as it is. This is not about my intention has never been to change the process of the grand jury. I think we have a fine system. The proposals that have come before this body in prior sessions have always been about recording the process as it is. So I am not a proponent of an overhaul of the grand jury system. I don't think that's a problem we need to solve. I think the problem is transparency.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. I would agree, Mr. Chair, with her assessment.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments for this panel? Thank you all very much for taking some time out of your day, and hope the rest of your days and meetings and hearings all go well. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and call up Gil Meyer and Senator Carter.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very, very much for allowing this bill to be heard. What I'd like to say to all of you is that 30 years ago, 1985, I sponsored this bill. It would appear to me that the day of enlightenment would hit our state in a way that we would try to deal with some of the people who do not believe in our criminal justice system, even right now. And it would appear to me also that all this bill is asking for is transparency. And God knows the people of America, and certainly in Oregon, needs to feel good about its criminal justice system. It is supposed to serve all of us and not just those at the top. And
Senator Carter, I know it's been a while since you've been before our committee, but I do need you to identify yourself.
I certainly do. Thank you.
Before you get too far on the roll here.
Thank you. I apologize. Margaret Carter.
Thank you.
But Mr. Chairman, I know everybody knows how emotional I get about stuff. I'm not just emotional about this issue. I think that it's a matter of a system that needs to be transparent to all of its citizens. And I think 496 is just asking, give us more transparency in our system. And I don't think that's too much for a government to respond to. And in a day when government is looked at in a very negative way, I would like to see Oregon legislature not go the way of many other states in this country that are not being transparent to its citizens. And so I'm asking you today to remember 30 years this bill has been before this body, 30 years ago, 1985. And so this is nothing new. This is nothing people just are complaining about in the last 2 or 3 years because of all the civil unrest across this country and so much of government not being transparent. This has been on our docket since 1985. I would urge you guys to please consider an aye vote on Senate Bill 496. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I intend to keep my comments brief. Thank you very much to the chair, and thank you very much to Senator Margaret Carter. So I agree. We've been a champion of this bill for quite some time, and we've always appreciated her stewardship of this issue. I just want to frame the testimony you're about to hear and frame the debate. Hopefully, the issue of whether or not Oregon should join the 21st century and record the grand jury has been resolved. Hopefully, you'll hear testimony from the district attorneys that they, too, agree that we need to go into a recording mode. We still operate out a statute from 1863 that asks a grand juror to take notes of the proceedings and record the substance of the evidence given before them. The question becomes, who should record? Whose duty is it to make the record? 496 places it on the courts. Senate Bill 505 places it on the district attorney. I understand from the chair that there'll be further discussions ferreting all those logistics out. The question becomes, what should be recorded? Should it be the fact witnesses, or should it be hearsay presented through a police officer? Senate Bills 496 and 505 preserve Oregon's longstanding rule, again since statehood, that the grand jury may only indict based on lawfully admissible evidence at trial. What that means is the fact witnesses get in before the grand jury and testify live. That is the procedure today. That is the procedure that is preserved in the bills. The Dash One's amendments would strip that protection and instead allow a grand jury to issue an indictment based only on the singular testimony of a police officer repeating what everybody else is saying. The next question becomes, who gets access to the record? Once the record is made, who gets access and under what conditions? 496 copies procedures that are in place in Idaho and in Alaska, Nevada, Hawaii, other neighboring states. It presumes the defense lawyer will have access to the record for the sole purpose of case preparation. Can't distribute it, can't give it to the client, but the defense lawyer has it under protective order. There is a protective order provision in this bill that goes beyond what is in the law in Idaho and Alaska, and it would allow the court to issue a protective order controlling access to the record in the event that there might be some particular unique case, like a gang case or something, where there's a concern for safety or reprisal. So as to the testimony, this has gotten bigger than us. The faith community is here, so you'll hear from some members from the community of the members of faith. You're going to be hearing telephone testimony from a former prosecutor from Alaska, from a former crime victim advocate in Idaho, and also you'll be hearing from some witnesses here. We've got from Oregon-based case stories. We've gotten a witness before the grand jury who had their the district attorney was telling them how to answer the questions. We have a suspect who was caught up in a prosecution where he was factually innocent. The district attorneys had that information, but they secured an indictment anyway. You'll hear from a defense lawyer who was defending a person charged with perjury before the grand jury and how the notes were inadequate for the purpose of knowing what it is his client had said that was false. And then you'll also hear from a certified court interpreter as to the difficulties of not recording a grand jury when you have an interpreter in the room. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So our next panel, before you step away, I should ask you, are there any questions? Senator Lithicum?
Curiosity, Ms. Meyer, can you describe your dash one again? It sounded like dash one was a modification that was substantial.
Chair Przanski and Senator Lithicum, thank you. The dash ones are not proposed by us. We support the Senate Bill 496. The dash ones are introduced by the District Attorney's Office, and it makes fairly significant changes. Number one, it requires a certified court interpreter rather than just an electronic recording. It allows for a grand jury to be issued upon hearsay testimony of a police officer, and the fact witnesses do not need to come into the grand jury at all. It does not allow the defense attorney to have access to the record as a matter of presumption. Rather, the defense attorney would have to make a showing to the court that the defense lawyer knew that there was something in that record that was material to the case and that that evidence was necessary to overcome a manifest injustice. I can tell you, Senator, that the defense bar never knows whether there's something that's necessary to overcome a manifest injustice that occurs because we're not in the room and we don't have access to the record. So not only do we think that's an unconstitutional standard, it's also logistically one that we simply could never meet.
Thank you for your explanation.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So our next panel is going to include the following. Pastor Matt Hennessy, Roger Martin, as well as Pastor E.D. Mundane, I hope that's correct, and then Dr. Shane Kinnison. So we'll need to bring, Roger, if you could get another chair so we have the four. Thank you very much. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm not sure if you've been before and given testimony, but if you'll identify yourself by name and then give us the testimony, and then we'll take questions at the end. Thank you. Who'd like to start? Everyone wants to be at the end. I got that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. And I want to make a practical example of one individual and what happened because the lack of recording. 2 weeks ago, the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety and the House Judiciary Committee visited McLaren. I went with them. We met a number of young men who've been there for 5-6 years. One in particular stands out because I went back to find out. Let's call him Charlie. I don't want to give his name. I don't want any retribution at him. Charlie, when he was 17 years old, was high on meth and robbed 2 convenience stores in the Portland metropolitan area. He was arrested. He was put in solitary confinement for 6 months. Mm. Now, that's another bill you're working on. For 6 months, by the time he was done, they could have waterboarded him to get anything to get out. He had a court-appointed attorney who suggested to him, we don't know what they're going to charge you with. You better darn well plead to something. And he was so desperate to get out, he pleaded to 2 6-year terms, first in McLaren, in the juvenile system. Now he is 24 and a half years old. He, within 4 months, will turn 25, and he's headed for the big house. He is completely cured of whatever the problem was. I've got 17-year-old. I've had 4 17-year-old sons, and I've got 6 grandsons. At age 17, they're crazy. And he was crazy. Unfortunately, he used a gun. It was unloaded, and he told me that. Well, I said, that doesn't matter at all if you unload a gun. You point a gun at somebody, you're arm robbing. He has gone through the juvenile system, for which we should be very proud, and turned out he's a stellar person. He's now got 6 more years, because had he been my son, I would have gotten a good criminal attorney to protect him. But typically, he comes from a questionable family, single parent, working, and low income, and he had no choice but to use the public defender who talked him into something he really shouldn't have done. That's the practical aspect of not knowing what goes on in a grand jury. I hope you pass one of these bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To our chair and to our committee, I am E.D. Mondinay, and I'm the pastor of Celebration Tabernacle in Portland, Oregon. This incredible opportunity to speak before you on this bill is very timely. We're dealing with mass incarceration where it concerns African-American men across the United States, but disproportionately in the state of Oregon. We are aware that 94% of state cases and 97% of all federal cases are pleaded out. I'll make this succinct and real brief. The equity in justice is compromised when there is procedural injustice of the grand jury system. The unparalleled power in the office of our district attorneys becomes a weapon of destruction when charges levied against anyone protected by the assumption of innocence until proven guilty is not adhered to. It becomes at risk. Disclosure of all and any evidence is crucial if there is to be an accurate and fair defense. Now, in my closing, please, I'm begging you to return the trust given to you by our local communities by embracing this 30-year-old ask of the Senate Bill 496.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, good morning.
Good morning.
Esteemed senators, my name is Dr. Shane Kennison. I'm pastor of the First Baptist Church in Gresham. I'm a citizen of Multnomah County. It's a joy to be with you today. I want to thank Ms. Meyer and Pastor Hennessy from Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church in Portland for inviting me to be a part of this today. Mr. Chairman, you have all the data before you. There's no data that I can bring that is new or revelatory for your consideration. And it's apparent by the testimony of Ms. Carter and others that you have been weighing this issue for many years. And so I find it oftentimes more helpful in listening to other people's words than my own. And so I would just simply share with you this in closing of my testimony to you and pass it over to Pastor Hennessy from the great American essayist, poet, and philosopher, and abolitionist Thoreau, who simply says, "It is not a man's duty, as a matter of course, to devote himself to the eradication of any, even to most erroneous wrong. He must still properly have other concerns to engage him. But it is his duty at least to wash his hands of it, and if he gives it no thought longer, not to give it practically his support. If I devote myself to other pursuits and contemplations, I must first see at least that I do not pursue them sitting upon another man's shoulders. I must get off him first, that he may pursue his contemplations also. See what gross inconsistency is tolerated. And with the passing of these bills, may we, as leaders and community members alike, remove ourselves from the shoulders of the individual so that that individual may be able to pursue his liberty and his freedom with all the access of information and data at his disposal for his own conscience and for his own sake. Thank you.
Thank you. Pastor Hennessy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, to you and to the committee. I'm grateful to be here. My name is J.W. Matt Hennessy, the pastor of Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church in Portland. And as I have to say many times, Mr. Chairman, around the state and the region, if you want to go to heaven, you have to go through Vancouver Avenue to get there. So I come to you today as one who has lived in this state for 28 years. I began my work here as the head of workers' compensation. So I walked these halls in the Senate and in the legislature as we had before us one of the most challenging issues of our time in workers' compensation. We were the sixth highest workers' compensation rates in the nation. And our goal was to say, how do we as Oregon come together with all of the various stakeholders and figure out a way to go from being the example of what not to be to become the example of what to be. We worked on that bill, what ended up becoming House Bill 1900, and it passed, as a matter of fact, in the legislature, and there's been no major reform since then. The point I'm making is that there were plenty who thought we could not be successful. We were. When there are two ways I look at this today. When Margaret Carter tells me anything, I do it. So I'm shocked that you all haven't done this already after 30 years. But what I, can say is this. We are Oregon. We have a national reputation of being innovative, of being leaders. In addition to having worked here at the state, I worked in business at Nike for 9 years globally. I led a company in Lake Oswego, and I pastor Vancouver Avenue for the last 12 years. Much of what I had to say has been said by many who have come before you, so I'd like to share these comments. Number one, I see this as a great opportunity for reform. I represent a community of people who have felt for a long time that justice has been deferred and that there are many disparities in the system. And in fact, when I had the opportunity to be briefed and to look at the summary of Senate Bill 496, I also called my friend and colleague, the District Attorney Rod Underhill, to get his take on it as well. He and I may differ in many ways as it relates to this, but I took what he had to say to me and I looked at the bill, and many of the things that he's concerned about are already covered from my perspective in the bill. So I think great work has already been done. The biggest issue that seems to be outlying is the question of the money issue here. And I would like to hope that justice matters more to us than how much it's going to cost.
Absolutely.
People's lives are at stake.
Yes.
It's very important that the table not be tilted, and the concerns that many have about discovery and are concerned about how much information goes from the grand jury to indeed the person being defended seem to be protected as a result of the fact that the defense attorney attorney is put in a much better position to understand what to do and how to prepare and information that cannot be shared with the person they're defending, and in ways in which we are also protecting many other people as well. I've said that this, from my perspective, is procedural justice. Mm-hmm. It's important that that the people who come before the system are feeling as if there is a balanced playing field. I'm working in our community to bring a balance and to create better relationships between faith and community and law enforcement. On the other hand, I'm also working with the judicial system, with our presiding judge, Nan Waller, and Judge Adrian Nelson and others, listening sessions that we're saying we have got to do something about the system. I see 496 as an integral part of that process of saying we need to look at what we're doing and how we can improve it. Finally, I would say, and I pray this hasn't felt like a sermon to you, is that I'm reminded of who we are as Oregonians, how innovative we are, how very much we are concerned about reform, and how we will not let roadblocks get in the way. I'm reminded of Tennyson's, the end of Tennyson's poem, where he said, "Though we are not that strength which in days of old moved heaven and earth, that which we are, one equal temper of heroic strength, made weak by time and faith, but strong in will to strive, to seek, and to find, but not to yield. I beg you not to yield. Let it not be another 30 years." Amen. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? All right, one comment, Pastor Hennessy. I can tell you from my first day of being in this process, and having Senator Carter at that time, Representative Carter, in our caucus, the wrath of Carter always put me underneath the table when she was speaking. So I appreciate and understand what you deal with on a more regular basis now. Any other comments?
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for
coming.
Thank you
very much.
Really appreciate
Thank you.
It. All right, at this point, our next panel is going to be Benny Williams and Eric Richardson. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Benny C. Williams. I'm a citizen of Oregon. I'm a citizen of the city of Salem. And I'm also the president of the Salem Kaiser branch of the NAACP. You know, speaking personally and on behalf of the Salem Kaiser branch of the NAACP, I'm here to express my support for SB 496. From our perspective, when I say ours, it's not just mine. I really want to emphasize that we've had dialogue within the branch of the NAACP and broadly across our community. This is legislation whose time has come. This bill allows grand juries of all 36 counties of Oregon to come into the 21st century by having testimony recorded. A version of this bill has been before this body, as Senator Carter pointed out, for more than 32 years. The first version of this came back in 1985 by Representative Margaret Carter. This legislation will bring fairness to our court system, fairness to our prosecutors and defense attorneys, fairness to the individuals being brought to justice. This legislation will reduce costs for our court and prison systems. And finally, fairness to the families of those going through the judicial system. There is no doubt in my mind or my community's mind that there are bad people out there. There are knuckleheads who are out there. And there are good people out there. They all deserve a fair and proper hearing by a grand jury proceedings that will allow them to be completely understanding of the charges that are coming against them and those who bring those charges against them. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric?
Yes, sir. Let me get a little issue here. Good morning, Chairman and Senators. My name is Eric Richardson. I represent the Eugene Springfield NAACP, an organization that has been concerned about fairness and procedural justice for more than 108 years. So we have been in this fight to make our nation a greater place, and that goes over into our state. Excuse me here. So I am here today in support of the OCDLA and Senate Bill 496. I would like to read a quote that you most likely have heard and read lately, but I'd like to read it again. Historically, the grand jury has been regarded as primarily a security to the innocent against hasty, malicious, and oppressive persecution. It serves the invaluable function in our society between the accuser and the accused, whether the accused is an individual, minority group, or other, to determine whether a charge is founded upon reason and was dictated by intimidation or by malice or personal ill will. This quote is from the court case Wood versus Virginia in 1962, pointing to the idea that this has been around and an issue for many years. As noted in the quote, the grand jury is meant to be balanced and indeed was envisioned as being a defense against cases of malice and ill will. After decades of disproportionate contact with the criminal justice system, African Americans, who are approximately 3% of the general population in the state of Oregon, yet make up 13% of the prison population, and others, simply ask that the intentions referred to in the case Wood versus Georgia be enacted in a meaningful way here in Oregon. Senate Bill 496 will balance Oregon's grand jury system by ensuring procedural fairness and transparency, which in time will go a long way to build trust between the courts and our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. All right, we're at this point going to be taking testimony by phone. I'm also going to ask Jason Short to please come forward. We're going to first be making contact with, I believe, Richard Payne. Good morning, Mr. Payne. This is Floyd Przanski with the Senate Judiciary Committee in Oregon. I understand that you have been placed on our registry as a witness, and we're wondering if we can go ahead and take your testimony at this time.
Yes, sir.
All right. So just to make clarification, you can hear us okay. If you have any problem not hearing us, please let us know. We'll do the same. And I was wondering if you have been following this online, just to know if you have a context of where we're at.
Yes, sir, and you're a handsome group.
Thank you very much. Flattery will get you everywhere, but if we have your name first, that would be great.
Yes, sir. My name is Richard Payne.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Payne. Please proceed.
Thank you. I attended Willamette School of Law from 1994 to 1997, which is just in your shadow across the street. I came to Alaska, worked as a district attorney for about 6 or 7 years in just outside of Anchorage, in an area called the Matsu Valley. I handled my first murder case from investigation through indictment, through trial, after only being at the DA's office 1 year. I was assigned numerous murder cases, sexual assault, DV cases without number. I was also assigned to the grand jury for 2 years, strictly as a grand juror, as the grand jury DA for 2 years. So I have a lot of experience with how Alaska does grand jury. I left the DA's office in 2001, December, opened up my own law firm with my partner, and we have been able to grow that firm into the largest criminal defense firm in the state of Alaska at this time. So I have quite a bit of experience with the grand jury system on both sides of the aisle. The first thing I want to talk to you today about is logistics. We use 12 to 18 grand jurors. We have one court clerk in the room at a computer station. making sure the recording is accurate and functional. There's one DA in the courtroom. Of course, defense attorney is not permitted in the courtroom. Either are any defendants or defense witnesses. However, the DA is required to provide fact witnesses. They do that through subpoena. Many of them are subpoenaed on scene by the officers at the time of the incident, so there's no additional cost or efforts to go locate these individuals later. Telephonic witnesses are allowed. You have to be 50 miles or more from the courthouse to be allowed to be telephonic. We use the hearsay rules in Alaska only allow for an officer to testify about what other officers said or did. They're not allowed to testify as to what a fact witness did or said. As for cost, it's minimal in the state of Alaska. I'm not exactly sure what projections Oregon is looking at, but it is minimal here in Alaska. We use a courtroom. We use a DA who's already, in Oregon anyway, doing grand juries. So I don't see any additional costs in district attorney's office. We use a court clerk. That time, in most of our jurisdictions, it's only a day a week or 2 days a week where you're actually in grand jury. So it's not a court clerk that's going to be completely 100% dedicated to grand jury. This would be someone that would be used throughout their court system, and then 2 days a week they would rotate through the grand jury here in Alaska. We also do pay our grand jurors for their time, but my understanding is $12.50 a day. So the 2 days a week that a grand juror would be participating would be about $24 or $25. Obtaining the record, that's the second area I wanted to touch on. In Alaska, it's not an automatic. You don't get the discovery with your normal discovery, police reports, audio recordings of the scene, et cetera. You don't get the grand jury. You have to actively order or request it through the courthouse. You can get it just in a CD, or it can be reproduced into a transcript. In my practice as a DA and as a defense attorney, it's not always necessary to have the grand jury recording. In certain types of crimes, it's clear enough from the other discovery that you don't need to go through the cost and effort to obtain the grand jury. The types of cases that you would need the grand jury on most regularly would be cases involving victims, not theft victims, but victims of violence usually. Let me take you through as I was a district attorney. There's some very strong positives to recording for a DA. Number one is you get to lock in the story. I'm sure this panel is not ignorant to the fact that in most DV cases, domestic violence victims recant. I'm sure in Oregon, it's much like Alaska, it's in the 80 to 90% that you're having a recanting victim in a DV case. However, in the initial few days of the case, the DV victim is usually on board with wanting to see some justice done. It's only after the honeymoon period and the cycle of violence kicks in that the DAs lose these witnesses and they recant. So my experience is in DV cases, which is the majority of the cases that we deal with at grand jury here in Alaska, those cases, you as a DA, I wanted to have the victim come in within a few days of the incident so I could lock in their story in a recorded statement before our grand jury, which was sworn. That was very valuable to me as a DA because later on, 80-something percent of them are going to go squirrely on me, and I'm not going to have a sworn statement. I'm going to have something on scene in the emotion, in the blood, the beer, and the battle, and it's not going to be as good as a statement 2 or 3 days later where they talk about their injuries, they talk about their pain, and they're still upset at the perpetrator. So I am surprised the DAs don't see the value in capturing that in a more calm fashion later on. And that would also bode well why you would want to have fact witnesses required to be a grand jury as a DA in order to lock in that story. I think that after they begin doing it, they'll taking grand jury in the proper way, in my opinion, that they'll see a lot of value in locking in those stories early on. Next part for a DA where I thought the grand jury was valuable was it was assisting in a negotiation. If you have a very strong grand jury presentation, your witnesses come in, they present well, they have a good recollection of what occurred, and you have a very strong grand jury, when that is discovered to the defense attorney, he sees or she sees that they have a powerful and very well thought out grand jury with witnesses that are going to appear and that are real people, and that does help in negotiation. DA can demonstrate the power of the testimony and the willingness of the witnesses with a recording of the grand jury. Simply through notes, I can't imagine how a defense attorney would know really what happened or if those grand jury witnesses are strong or weak. So that's another tool for the DAs, is use it in negotiation to show how strong their cases are. And that has a flip side, doesn't it? It also will teach the DA or show the DA how weak their case is. If they have to bring in their fact witnesses, swear them in, take testimony, they'll be able to see that their witnesses aren't as strong as the police report shows, not as good as they thought they were, and they'll also be able to reflect back on that on a recording and or a transcript later to make sure they remember exactly how the grand jury went down. Very valuable in preparing your case for trial as well, to have that grand jury testimony to review, to remember exactly what was said and how it was said under oath. The DA, I've heard some discussion and read some articles regarding the re-traumatization of the victims. In Alaska, I've never had a situation where a victim didn't expect to be recorded in a court proceeding with a DA in a criminal case involving a felony matter. I've never had them not automatically assume that this was going to be captured in some way. The DA can minimize any trauma for victims of the grand jury that can't be, because a grand jury is set up in a very friendly way for a victim. It's a good test drive of talking about these incidences in front of other people. You have 12 to 18 citizens that usually don't talk or don't say very much. You have a court clerk who doesn't look up from her computer because she's trying to work on the recording. The only person the victim is talking to is a DA, someone they should be developing a relationship with anyway, and it helps them prepare for what a trial will be like, what kind of questions they will receive. So actually, a DA can minimize the trauma by taking them through the grand jury process, and it's a good education for the victim on how it's going to go. I think it would be unfair and somewhat cruel to throw a victim, especially a sex crime victim, in front of a jury 6, 9 months, a year down the road after the incident without having gone through a process like a grand jury where they can kind of have a test drive of how they're going to be able to do and what it's going to be like. Just looking through my notes, make sure I'm not missing anything as when I was a DA. Another factor about the re-traumatization of victims or victim, how it's unfair to a victim, I would wager that there's not a victim out there that doesn't understand that they could be brought before a very public trial and have to provide testimony in front of a group of strangers or the world in an open courtroom. A grand jury is a much more friendly environment. Other thing is, as a DA in Alaska, even though we had recording, I think we've had it since statehood, we have had incidences where district attorneys have done things that have been improper. You could hear them on a little bit off the record chatting or the grand jury laughing. So after a defense attorney got the recording, was able to listen to it and go into some inquiry and actually be able to talk to the district attorney's office and get some other additional CDs, they were finding out that certain DAs were using the grand jury off record time to build relationships that were improper. Talking about family things, talking about defendants off the record and telling them about their criminal histories, things that would never be allowed. So because we had the recording, we had a little bit of snippet of recordings of where these DAs were making these mistakes and going overboard and developing these relationships and making the grand jury a rubber stamp for the DA's office. Because we had the recordings, we were able to ferret that out. Right now in Oregon, I can't imagine... I have to tell you, it's quite shocking that you're not recording. It's a Wizard of Oz type stuff. I can't imagine how you can function and why your judiciary hasn't fixed this a long, long time ago. The grand jury, the DA's office has carte blanche to do anything they want and develop those relationships any way they want. And once the grand jury identifies with your DA, the DA is able to move and manipulate that grand jury at will. and there is no oversight. There's no check and balance on the DA's office. And I'm not trying to bash the DA's either, but I can tell this panel that the DA's job was the best job I ever had. I got to wear a white hat, stroll into court, and be the man. And the grand jury, they see the DA in that fashion because they're normal, average, everyday citizens. So it's a very dangerous relationship without any type of oversight. But to have zero oversight is just asking for trouble and asking for that relationship to take a wrong turn and become too close. I wanted to spend a lot more time on oversight of your DA's office, but I don't want to belabor the point. Others have mentioned it. The last area I wanted to touch on was procedural justice as a defense attorney. It would be, we have to recall and start with the premise, because our system requires it. The DAs would agree, the defense attorneys would agree, that every person brought before the grand jury is innocent until proven guilty. So you have an innocent victim who will be testifying, and you have an innocent person who is going to be brought into the system through the grand jury. That's the premise we have to begin with. It is completely unjust to leave the state in a power position based on inequity of information. What I mean by that is, if the state is the only one that knows how those witnesses presented themselves, if the state is the only one that knows how the testimony came across to the grand jurors, if the state is the only one that knows what happened at the grand jury, the defendant is left at such a lurch, a person who is innocent until proven guilty, that I can't imagine how your system has functioned for 30 years and how a defense attorney can honestly sit down with a defendant and say, this is how the testimony is going to come across. You're going to be found guilty of this, this, and this, and this is why you should take a deal. With the grand jury, with that recording, with a transcript, you can sit down with your client and really go over what happened. This is what they're going to say. This is how they're going to sound on the stand at a jury trial, and this is why we have a chance, or this is why you have to take the deal. In Alaska, we have a saying that talks about how the grand jury power is both a shield and a sword of justice. The shield is the grand jury's function is to protect people who are innocent of crime and not let a true bill go forward where they'll be subject to the ridicule of their neighbors, their loss of employment, and the stigma of being indicted. That's the shield. The sword of justice is easy to see. Oregon has the sword of justice. What you lack is the shield. I really appreciate the opportunity to be heard today. I wanted to fly down there and be there in person, but unfortunately, apparently King Salmon is worth more than my butt in the seat.
Thank you again. I understand there are a lot of people that are hungry for King Salmon, and they appreciate you not taking up that seat.
But those winter kings are pretty good.
All right. Mr. Payne, thank you very much. Hang on one second. Let me ask the committee if anyone has any questions for Mr. Payne, because we're going to have another telephone witness.
I don't have any questions, but I really like to thank him for his testimony. It added a lot of clarity when we're looking at what we're trying to accomplish here and what's already been practiced in Alaska. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Payne, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Payne. It's kind of nice to have that perspective from, I guess, both sides of the grand jury. I do have a question about, did you notice any uptick do you notice that there are more court proceedings, perhaps, that would take place because the defense, I mean, I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but I'm just wondering if the defense is able to successfully, pick apart what happened in a grand jury and get a case dismissed, or is it more the other way, where the grand jury is able to indict and keep that indictment going through? Do you understand?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, I do understand it. It's an excellent question. The process of the grand jury in Alaska, if you're able somehow to find something that would get a grand jury overturned. First of all, the case law is very, very tight. It's hard to do that, extremely hard to do that. If you're successful, they can reindict. So a lot of defense attorneys don't file grand jury motions because all the state will do is just turn around and reindict. As a DA, if I ever caught a grand jury motion that I thought was good, that was a good grand jury motion, again, which was rare, I would not even bother responding to the motion. I would just go back and reindict. It was a much quicker way to get around that problem. Normally, how you get to the grand jury asking for a grand jury to be dismissed is you file a motion that you would have filed anyway based on the discovery that you received in the case, a search motion, let's say, that someone effected an improper search or without a search warrant. And then once you get that evidence thrown out based on the recordings of the scene, based on the police reports, interviewing witnesses, et cetera, once that piece of information is removed from the case, if the DA won't come to the table and reduce the charge or dismiss just based on the suppression of evidence, you can then go file another motion saying, okay, now that this evidence is suppressed and would not have been allowed is not allowable to be in a court of law, it shouldn't have been brought before the grand jury. Therefore, you can file a grand jury motion based on the suppression of evidence of another motion. But grand jury motions standing alone all by themselves, very rare.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Mr. Payne, thank you again for your time. We really appreciate it, and we hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You guys have a great day in the great state of Oregon. I loved my time there.
Well, thank you, sir.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. All right. Our next witness scheduled is, I believe, Anna Mamani, if I'm not mistaken. Good morning. This is Floyd Przanski, and we've got a little feedback on this to just make sure that's cleared away. So is this Ms. Mamani?
Mamani.
Mamani. Excuse me. I apologize. Ms. Mamani, have you been able to follow the proceedings online?
I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we appreciate you being available in Idaho to take this call. If you'll give us your name, and we'll take your testimony and see if there's any questions following. Thank you very much.
Of course, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Anna Mamani. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Boise, Idaho. I'm a former prosecutor for the Ada County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. And prior to attending law school in Eugene, I was a victim witness coordinator with the Canyon County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, and I worked there as a victim witness coordinator working primarily with Spanish-speaking victims of crimes. And if you can imagine, Spanish-speaking victims are not only fearful of their assailants, but also of just being involved in the criminal justice process altogether. So I was dealing with an especially vulnerable demographic of the population. As a victim witness coordinator, I worked with victims of sex abuse, of domestic violence, and of homicides. I'm not the victim, but the victim's family, obviously. And a lot of those cases were the ones that did go through grand jury proceedings. I reviewed the news articles, I reviewed the bills, and I understand the opposition's hesitation or their position regarding re-victimization of these victims by having these proceedings recorded. I think that I would offer it, in my experience as a victim witness coordinator, the recording of those proceedings was not the deterring factor for these victims. The deterring factor was them telling their story and then not being believed, or the fear of not knowing what was going to happen. It wasn't that it was going to be recorded. I think that the grand jury proceeding in and of itself is a strange process for most people unless you've actively participated in one. And so just the fear of the unknown, I think, was more of the concern for the victims that I dealt with. To remedy that, it's going to take the victim witness coordinators and the prosecutors to work together to educate their victims, to prepare their victims, to take a little extra time so that those victims are aware of exactly what's going to happen. When I received the call to help or to testify with at this hearing, my mind immediately went to a victim that we had. She was 6 years old. She was enticed out of her front yard by a neighbor boy. She was abused and left in the alley to die. She was obviously very traumatized. She had been in counseling. We took her to when we were getting ready to do the grand jury proceeding, We took her to the courtroom. We let her sit in the jury box. We let her sit on the witness stand. She sat in the judge's chair. And the entire time, we asked her questions about kind of what we would ask during a grand jury proceeding. So she was very comfortable. She knew the procedure and process. When she went into the courtroom, I wasn't allowed to go in with her during grand jury proceedings, so she went in by herself with the DA. And we could hear her in the hallway. She had apparently grabbed onto the microphone and was shouting her answers into the microphone because we had told her, when you testify, you have to speak up so that everyone can hear you and it's going to be recorded. And this little girl had the strength and courage to literally shout her answers. She wasn't going to leave that courtroom without everyone understanding what she had to say. So as long as the victim witness and the prosecutor educate those victims about exactly what this process is, they're going to dispel that fear. And I think that would remedy a lot of the concerns that maybe the opposition has as far as re-victimization. So I'm a defense attorney in the state of Idaho. I was a prosecutor. As a prosecutor, I handled no grand jury cases. As a defense attorney, I've handled no grand jury cases. I believe this to be primarily I refuse to take cases that involve allegations of domestic violence or sex abuse, just on a personal basis for me as a result of my work with victim witness. Although when this was brought to my attention, if I put on my defense attorney hat, my first instinct is, why aren't they taking these cases to trial? They need to be taking these cases to trial. I can't imagine trying to sit with a client without having a good understanding or good basis of what the strength or weaknesses of the state's case is and encouraging that person to take a plea. From my own perspective, it seems like a hard sell. And I feel like maybe some of these individuals are pleading or taking those deals as a result of trying to avoid maybe the imposition of a severe sentence. I do believe that recording these proceedings is going to give defense attorneys the ability to more strongly recommend a resolution or proposal or proposed resolution in the case, which could aid the DA's office in putting a lot of these cases to bed before a victim actually has to go before their accuser or their assailant. Without knowing that the strength of the state's case, I just can't imagine. It should be a hard sell to the defendant to get them to plead guilty. I do believe that with a grand jury transcript, it keeps the state honest. It lends a lot of credibility to the justice system. And people who are charged with crimes are pleading because they're actually guilty and not because they're fearing the imposition of a severe sentence. And so it seems odd to me, but I don't believe that recording the testimony is the basis in which victims are going to turn away from participating in the process.
So. All right, thank you. Questions for Ms. Mamani? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you, Ms. Mamani. I was trying to follow, I guess, a little bit. You said you went to school in Eugene, and then you said you're in Boise now. Where were you the victim coordinator? Was it in Idaho, or was it somewhere else?
So Canyon County Prosecutor's Office is the county that neighbors Ada County. So Nampa, Caldwell, Idaho.
Okay, thank you. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll follow up. Thank you. You said that a lot of victims of sex abuse cases and murders. Many went through grand jury. If they didn't go through grand jury, what else did they do?
We went through a preliminary hearing proceeding. Generally, more vulnerable victims were the cases that we chose to take through grand jury. All other cases went through a preliminary hearing. So if we had, for example, a domestic violence victim who was, that was the last time we knew she was committed to participating in the testimony, she was committed to participating in the criminal prosecution, we would take her through the preliminary hearing phase. And either the defendant, she would either testify in front of the defendant or they would waive their hearing and be bound over into district court. And so those were the two methods that we had. But if we had an emotional victim, a highly traumatized victim, we took them through the grand jury proceeding.
Any follow-up?
Yeah, I was going to ask how cases were divided up, I guess. Yep. It sounds like it's more sensitive cases went to the grand jury, and then more solid cases went to preliminary.
Ms. Mamani, let me just clarify. If I remember correctly, we've had testimony before from others who practice in Idaho, and that the premises that are used there are that the preliminary hearing is a tool that's more frequently used than in other states that have the grand jury process. So I think what I'm taking away from your testimony is that the assistant district attorney would determine whether or not they thought the case should go to either of those, and taking into factor the impact that it could have on the victim in being in a public setting, which would be the preliminary hearing, or is in a closed setting with the grand jury?
Absolutely. It was the prosecutor's discretion on whether or not, once that report had come in, whether or not to take it through a grand jury proceeding. And it was a collaborative decision between the investigating officers, the prosecutors, and the victim witness coordinators on how is this victim going to be able to perform. Is she going to be able to participate in a grand jury proceeding, or will she be okay if we go through a preliminary? It was always our premise to take care of the victim and make sure that person was being thoughtfully taken care of through this through the process.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Ms. Mamani, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you appearing by phone.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. And our last witness in this panel, Jason Short. Mr. Short.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I've been informed that my time is limited and we're going over time, so I'm going to be brief, especially in light of what Mr. Payne was able to testify to. He was able to address really most of the issues that I was going to address, but to give you brief background, I too attended Willamette University for law school, graduated in 2000. During my third year of law school, I was a lead certified law clerk at the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuting misdemeanors on federal land in federal court. I was then hired on by Bob Herman, who was then a fairly new deputy or DA, replacing Scott Upham, and was there from 2000 to 2008. From 2002 to 2008, I prosecuted felony cases, almost exclusively felony cases, and during that time took maybe hundreds, I don't know, dozens and maybe a lot of cases to grand jury. And since then, the last 8 years, I've been in private practice. I'm one of the partners in the law firm Gilroy Napoli Short Law Group. Our law firm is made up of former prosecutors, so it's a bit unique from that perspective. So from looking at this case, and I appreciate what Richard Payne was able to testify to, I just would echo those sentiments and what he said. They are correct. They are exactly the same things that I would experience, or I have experienced, with the exception of not having recorded grand jury notes. I've had access to grand jury notes in the past. I have defended a perjury case where I was privy to those grand jury notes. Recently, in another case, I have had access to those notes as well. And so I've had a chance to look at those. And of course, as a prosecutor, I had an opportunity to look at the notes that were stored in the chief deputy DA's office in the event that it was necessary for me to look at those as a prosecutor. What's helpful for me, and I want to emphasize this, what's helpful was as a deputy DA taking cases to grand jury, and I know this is what Mr. Payne said as well, it's important for me to look at who those people are that are testifying. It's important for me to, and for lack of a better term, size them up. Are they someone that's invested in my case as a prosecutor? Are they willing to come in? Did we have to subpoena them multiple times to get them to come in? And how cooperative were they? And how believable were they? Those seven grand jurors that are not only looking at me, but more importantly, looking at the witnesses who are testifying are also determining the believability of that person's testimony. And that's an important part versus just a police officer coming in and saying, okay, I'm going to testify as to hearsay to these individuals and what they told me. I think that is not It's not fair to the grand jury when they're making a decision to return a true bill or no true bill based on limited testimony and hearsay that wouldn't necessarily be admissible if it went to trial. That it would be required that those individuals testify at the trial. And to have something proceed differently in front of the grand jury when they're making that important decision to come back with an indictment on those charges, again, with that presumption of innocence until someone's proven that they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's a high bar, it's a high standard, and it should be taken seriously. It should be recorded, but also those individuals should have to come in and testify. And I, again, reiterating what Mr. Payne said, I have not had a victim that I can recall to come to me and express fear or anxiety that it was being recorded. In fact, a laptop was always used, and the person that was the foreperson for the grand jury would be the one that would just be typing the entire time that someone would be testifying. So you kind of hear that constant tapping, and depending on how fast, usually I think they would pick the fastest typist as the foreperson and type and try to get as much information as possible. It was very obvious to whoever was testifying that it was being notes and were being taken. It wasn't recorded, but as much information as bless his or her heart, trying to get as much of the testimony as they possibly could through typing. And in Washington County, it was all person crimes that went to grand jury, and then it was drug crimes that involved one witness, like a PCS, we would do preliminary hearings. So that's kind of depends on every office how they structure that. So I would just, again, talk about the importance or just, again, repeat how important it is to have individuals and the concern I have with hearsay statements coming in.
Ms. Short, thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Short? Senator Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you. No, I didn't quite expect it to end so quickly and get called on so quickly. I just didn't want him to leave yet. But are grand juries in Oregon treated differently county to county? In other words, are they all randomly selected from the jury pool? Are they handpicked and interviewed as to what their biases might be? How does that work?
Well, I don't necessarily know for other counties, but at least for Washington County, my understanding is probably, I think, the second largest county, so it's a very large county. We had a grand jury every day. Sometimes we would have two different grand juries in one day, an A panel and a B panel, made up of seven grand jurors, but they were picked from the jury pool, and they served for a period of about a month, four weeks or so. But they were, and then when we needed a new panel, we took them from that day, from when jurors came just thinking they were going to be listening to a normal trial, and then they just got picked at a grand jury, and I go, great, you're here for once a week or twice a week for 4 weeks.
And yep. Then sort of a follow-up, but I guess gone on a different topic. I've heard a lot of concern about maybe DAs being inappropriately or kind of setting up a relationship that might give more credence, I guess, to what the DA says as to then the other way. I'm just wondering if you've seen that or experienced that on either side, and would better instruction to potential grand jurors be appropriate coming from a third party, perhaps, instructing them as to what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate, what they're expected to do, what shouldn't be happening in that room?
I think it would be helpful. I think that's a legitimate concern. There's a lot of downtime. Sometimes if I've got two or three grand juries scheduled in a row and I'm done with one grand jury and then I'm waiting for those witnesses to appear, there's times I'd just sit and hang out with the grand jury and just chat with them. They'd get to know me, I'd get to know them. And then at the end of that month, it was pretty friendly. I knew their names sometimes. I could see them in the street. They'd go, oh, hey, I remember you. You were the DA. So there was a relationship that was developed. I absolutely. And so as to what impact that had, I don't know. I hope it didn't influence their decision, but it may have. It certainly may have.
All right, Mr. Short, thank you very much. Our next panel includes Richard Rowe, Jennifer Nash, Joseph Smith.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the Judiciary Committee, excuse me. My name is Jennifer Nash. I'm a lawyer in Corvallis. My practice is limited to criminal defense, family law, and juvenile law. I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 496 and support grand jury recording. I've submitted a longer written statement with background information regarding the testimony that I'm giving this morning because I'm going to talk to you about a very complicated case. Grand jury recording protects innocent people from wrongful convictions. I represent a man who will be testifying shortly who was wrongfully accused of sexually abusing his daughter. If he had been convicted, he could have faced a mandatory minimum sentence of 100 years in prison. During a custody proceeding, the mother of my client's child made repeated false allegations of sexual abuse against my client. His daughter never made any disclosures of abuse, and there was no physical evidence to substantiate the mother's allegations. After my client moved to a different jurisdiction, she repeated her allegations to a new police agency who began a new investigation. The new detective had the mother collect the child's underwear after she came from my child's home, and those underwear were sent to the Oregon State Crime Lab. Prior to grand jury, the assigned prosecutor and detective had discussions with the forensic science at the Oregon State Crime Lab. The forensic scientist told them that in the absence of any semen on the child's clothing, any of my client's DNA found on his daughter's underwear would not be probative of sexual abuse. Put plainly, when people live together, their DNA ends up on each other's clothing. And if the DNA wasn't in any kind of seminal fluid, which would indicate possible sexual contact, there were lots of explanations other than sex abuse, including the fact that laundry gets done in the same washing machine and DNA can be transferred. There was no seminal fluid located on any evidence that was submitted to the crime lab in this case. The assigned prosecutor and detective failed to inform the grand jury what the crime lab told them. They simply presented the lab report to the grand jury that indicated that my client's DNA was on his daughter's clothing. Without the explanation offered by the Oregon State Crime Lab, the grand jury concluded that because my client's DNA was on his daughter's clothing, he must have sexually abused his daughter, and they indicted him. My client was indicted for 2 counts each of sodomy in the first degree and sexual abuse in the first degree, and was arrested on a Friday night. After I called the elected district attorney and asserted my client's innocence, he called the crime lab and spoke to the forensic scientist himself. After verifying what I told him, the charges were dismissed and my client was released from jail after spending days believing his life as he knew it was over. Grand jury recording holds prosecutors and police accountable and ensures that they present all evidence that's relevant to the grand jury. If they make a mistake or they misunderstand the evidence that's presented, it allows the defense attorney immediate access to that information where those mistakes would be discovered. I urge you to vote aye on Senate Bill 496.
Thank you.
Hello, committee members, Senator Przanski. My name is Joseph Schmidt. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 496. I'm a single father of a 5-year-old daughter. I've been an active parent to my daughter, co-parenting with her mother for most of our daughter's life. I graduated in 2015 magna cum laude research fellow and am now in graduate school at OSU, working for a master's degree. On July 23rd of 2016, Corvallis Police Department came to my door in the middle of the night to arrest me. They took me to the police station where they charged me with 4 felonies, all Jessica's Law felonies. I am innocent of these charges. My daughter's mother made multiple reports against me, and I fully cooperated with all aspects of the investigations. Nonetheless, I was arrested. My mugshot was put online where it remains today, written in indelible ink, where it will remain for posterity, along with the foul charges for which I was arrested. I spent 3 grim days in jail, isolated and terribly afraid of what lay before me and my daughter. I sat alone in my cell with nothing to do but think and to try to control my fear. I knew that if I was convicted, I would grow old and probably die in prison, where I would be marked as a child molester and tormented by other inmates. I knew that if I was convicted, my life was essentially over, And by far the worst of it was that I knew my daughter would grow up without her father, being taught that I had abused her. I thought about missing her first day of kindergarten, never helping her with her homework or teaching her to ride her bike. I was going to miss her childhood and everything else. This was an unbearable thought, but one which I could not avoid thinking endlessly. I was sure all this would happen if I was convicted, though I couldn't see how I would be convicted of something I did not do. I still had faith in the criminal justice system, though quickly diminishing faith. If I was not convicted, I thought, my life would still be ruined. The newspapers would publish the charges with my mugshot, if indeed they hadn't already. The results of this alone would be devastating. All my work at school over the past years would be for nothing. I wouldn't be able to get a job. The world would see me as something I was not. My reputation would forever be tarnished, and I would be a pariah. My mind always came back to this question. How could this have happened? How could they have gotten a grand jury to indict me? Why would the DA want to when she was in possession of all the facts of the case? My attorney once told me that one can indict a ham sandwich, and I guess that must be true because they indicted me when there was no evidence of my guilt and ample evidence of my innocence. This question remains, and it will always remain, because these grand jury indictment proceedings are not only secret, but there is no record of them. I was released after 3 days, minutes before my arraignment hearing, because my attorney brought the facts of the case to the elected DA. For several months, I could not return home to sleep in my bed for fear of being wrongfully arrested again. When I was at work, I stayed by the window, always looking out to see if there was a police vehicle. Every time the lab door opened, I was paralyzed with fear that someone had come to take me back to jail. I knew that all of these fears were irrational, but they were my constant companion nonetheless. I understand the secrecy of grand jury proceedings, and I understand why those proceedings need to be kept secret, at least until an arrest is made. But that does not mean that there should be no record of them. Without a record, prosecutors can say or do anything without fear of consequences, as they did in my case. My liberty was taken from me when I was wrongfully arrested, and my future, all my goals, and my hard work is now in jeopardy. My life will never be the same. If there were a record of the grand jury proceedings, the DA would not have been so brazen as to withhold information, and none of this would have happened. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 496 requiring the recording of grand jury proceedings so others' lives won't be ruined like mine.
Thank you. Mr. Rowe.
Good morning. My name is Richard Rowe. I'm a businessman in Klamath Falls. I was told that this is constraint on time, so I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version of my dealings with the Klamath Falls grand jury. I waited in the hallway for an hour and a half for the hearing to begin because they were convening a new grand jury. The ADA was inside there kibitzing with them the whole time, trying to bring them over onto her side of thinking. I was the third one to testify in front of the grand jury. When I got in there, I was sworn in by the foreman of the grand jury. I was asked questions about a suspect. I answered the questions correctly and honestly. And then at that point, the ADA decided to go ahead and ask me questions about another suspect who I did not see there. And she asked me if I saw her there, and I said, no, I'll tell you exactly what I said to the police officers. I said I saw the south end of a woman going north over a fence. I never saw her face. That was in the police report. When I know exactly that I said that because one of the people in the grand jury kind of smirked at my statement. The ADA did not like my statement that I could not identify her. So she insisted that I identify her. And I told her, I know what the person looks like, and all I saw was her rear. At that point, the ADA started to badger me because I was not given the testimony that she wanted. She made a statement to me about one of the victims. Person from the grand jury asked me a pointed question, which surprised me. And I went to answer that question, but before I could answer it, the ADA answered the question. And so I turned in my seat and I said, excuse me, That question was directed towards me, not you, and that is not the answer that I would give. So I turned and I gave the answer to the grand jury member of what I knew was true. The ADA at that time said that she wanted this one person to have charges of being a transit. And I says, no, he's not a transit. You know where he lives, because a week ago you sent your police department to his house to arrest him on another charge. At that point, she started to badger me. So I decided, I really don't need this. I'm going to give yes or no answers and get my butt out of there. And that's what happened. Then, about 6 weeks later, I get a call from a private investigator investigating this charges this woman was brought up on per my testimony that I saw her there. And I told the private investigator at that time, I didn't tell him that I saw him there. You can read the transcripts. And I was advised there was no transcripts taken because she was using my eyewitnesses putting her there. During the whole time of me giving testimony, she was standing at a podium with a three-ring binder, and over on the side there was a table with some electronics. And she would ask me different questions and go over and play with electronics. So I was surprised my testimony was not being recorded. And because of what I told the private investigator, that all I saw was the south end of a woman going north over a fence, they dropped the charges. The person that they wanted to bring the charges against, I know her, I know what she looks like, but I don't know what she looks like from behind. And that was my testimony. And I felt that I was badgered by the ADA. She had a different agenda because she said she wanted to get proof against this person to arrest her. And I couldn't give it to her.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward and Mr. Smith being willing to come forward and tell us your story. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm looking at a time check here. We have a couple more people that are scheduled to testify for the proponents. Looking at who they are and where they are from, I am going to ask for Mr. James Comstock to please come forward. And I'm going to go ahead and ask to make certain we have enough time. Steve Dole and Aaron Olson, if you two would come up, we'll take your testimony just to make sure, unless you, we may be carrying over the problem, and I want to make certain those who are further away, who are not normally here, have an opportunity to testify today so they don't have to make the trip a second time. Mr. Comstock, so Steve, did you want to come up with Ms. Olson, or did you want to wait? I may try to do some tomorrow. I'm going to probably try to clear some stuff. I think I looked at the docket. So why don't we do this? Mr. Comstock, why don't you just move over?
Sure.
It sounds like you all want to wait a second. So I'm going to go ahead and bring up the rest of, of this panel, which would be Jeff Carter and Kimberly. I'm going to let you hold off because I can bring you back up at another time. Mr. Comstock, if you'll get started, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is James Comstock. I'm a licensed private investigator working in the state of Oregon. I live in Washington County. I previously worked as a court-certified interpreter in Oregon and in Idaho. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 496. I believe that an audio record in grand jury is essential so that it can be determined that everyone, the prosecution, the defense, and the court, are aware whether a witness testimony has been accurately translated. From my years working as an interpreter and from my work as a defense investigator in the Oregon courts, I'm aware that frequently district attorneys do not use certified interpreters in grand jury. This is particularly true with lesser used languages and in smaller and more rural counties. This is a problem because it creates a proverbial black box where evidence comes in and a decision is made by the grand jury. Excuse me, but there is no way to know if the witness testimony was interpreted accurately or not. We're all familiar with situations where people speaking different languages struggle to communicate, either with or without an interpreter. However, the most dangerous situation in interpreting is when English speakers and non-English speakers believe that they are communicating when, in fact, unbeknownst to all parties, communication is broken down. This can occur when an interpreter believes that he or she is interpreting correctly, though errors are being made, and English and the non-English speakers are both unaware. I encourage the Senate Judiciary Committee to pass Senate Bill 496 because it's critical to the fair administration of justice.
Thank you. And Jeff?
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Carter. And I am not a criminal defense lawyer. I practice in juvenile law here in Marion County. And as such, a case came before me that was a bit shocking, but I'll give you the brief facts. I was representing a victim of domestic violence, and there were some cultural issues that I had to manage and also trying to navigate the landscape for domestic violence intervention, FAPA, you name it, those types of things. And during the course of the prosecution of her husband, apparently the husband did not respond appropriately to his indictment. He was intending to take it to trial, and as we were working up to that trial date, the same prosecutor indicated that he was going to indict my client for perjury. She had given a statement to the police. She had testified at the grand jury that indicted her husband, and according to my client, she testified consistently with what she had given to the police officer at the grand jury. There wasn't a second grand jury that was impaneled. As near as I can tell, the DA went back to that same grand jury and then indicted my client for perjury based upon her statements that were apparently contrary to other witnesses that testified before the jury. So when we got the indictment, it was not clear what statements she was actually being prosecuted for. So as a result of that, I made a motion to the court. The court agreed that there was not enough information to move forward and ordered disclosure of additional information. The only information that we ever got through discovery was the handwritten notes. And the handwritten notes were totally unsatisfactory to help assist this this woman. Now, I don't know exactly where this would have ended up, because what did happen was that the defendant's husband did end up resolving his case, and immediately upon that, the perjury case was dismissed. I'm convinced that the purpose of indicting the victim was to gain leverage on the case against her husband, and I'm equally convinced that this type of 496, if it were in place, this would not have happened. So I urge and I vote for 496. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. So I'm going to ask again, Steve and Aaron, did you want to give testimony now or did you want to hold off? If you're ready, I'm
sorry, Chair Brzezinski.
All right, so my next panel, Steve, thank you. Our next panel is going to be Kevin Neely, Walt Bigelow, and Lisa Donnell.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Thank you for giving us some time this morning. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I wanted to just very briefly give you, hopefully very, very briefly, give you an overview of how grand jury works and give you a quick hit on what our DA's Association has really uncovered as it relates to grand jury proceedings around the country. Our goal in providing this information to you is, again, we're not here to tell you that grand jury recordation is not the best practice, but we are here to ask that if you pursue this practice, you do it in a well-informed way based on information that is gathered from other states around the country. So again, I want to take 2 or 3 minutes to walk you through what's happening in other states. I wanted just to start by saying thank you to Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. They've spent over 200 hours collecting this information. And then I wanted to pass on OLIS. There are 4 documents I put that really capture in much broader terms the information I'm going to briefly hit on today. There is an overview of grand jury in all 50 states, a discussion of the statutes, how evidence is presented to grand jury, and whether or not protective orders are available. Again, I'm not going to spend but 30 seconds talking to you about the history of grand jury. It is a very robust history. It dates back to the Magna Carta. And the role of the grand jury process is really to be a way to make sure that in that instance, it was the king. I don't think that anyone will argue that the DAs are kings and queens these days. But the role is to ensure that they are not abusing their power in a way that is vindictive. How has it manifested itself today? Again, the role is not to decide whether or not the person is innocent or guilty, but to decide whether or not the DA is okay to move forward with that case. The grand jury then looks at that evidence and is responsible for a true bill or a not true bill. They are operated in secret. I don't think there's anyone here that's arguing they shouldn't continue to operate in secret. There are good reasons for that. The prosecutor does indeed provide the vast majority of the questioning, and the witnesses provide the evidence at the grand jury proceeding, and there is no judge present. And finally, as you have already heard, there are 7 grand jurors. They are collected from a random pool, just as any jury is, and it requires the vote of 5 of those grand jurors to move forward a true bill. I have this slide in just to quickly show you that it's not just a matter of the district attorney collecting the information from the police officer and running off to the grand jury. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of information gathering work that has to happen in a very short period of time, and the grand jury component is just one component in that process. Again, all of this information is available on OLIS, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time walking you through this diagram. Grand jury is a grand jury statute in all 50 states, but grand jury is really only used in 39 states in any meaningful way. And when I say in any meaningful way, that's if they take just 1 or 2 cases a year to grand jury, as is the case in some jurisdictions. There are 11 states that just, while they may have a grand jury law on the books, they simply don't use grand jury. Grand jury is recorded, as you already know, in the vast majority of states. I think if you look closely at this slide, what you'll see is those states that are in purple are states that don't currently have a recordation requirement. Many of those states don't actively practice grand jury as we do here. The states in green are states that do have an explicit recordation requirement. So again, we're not here to tell you that that is not what's happening nationwide. Most states do, in fact, if they have a grand jury law, require the grand jury to be recorded. Here is another slide that I think is helpful and informative. These are the states that predominantly use grand jury. I know Senator Thatcher asked a question earlier about how cases are indicted. There are 3 principal ways cases are indicted. Way 1 is the way that's practiced here in Oregon almost exclusively, and that is the use of a grand jury. Way 2 is a preliminary hearing. That is another and perhaps more common method of getting a case indicted. In those instances, the case is essentially brought before a judge, and the defense has an opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses in that instance. That practice has been in place in Oregon in the past, but really since the early 80s, mid-80s, most of the district attorneys do use the grand jury process. And then finally, there are states that are able to directly process cases. They don't have to use either a grand jury or a preliminary hearing. So again, there are 17 states in the nation that consistently use the grand jury process. Again, a big issue that you know that is of interest to us is how is evidence presented to that grand jury. This slide gives you an overview of how most states handle the evidence in front of the grand jury. The states that are in red require the evidence code to be used in the grand jury process. The states that are in blue have either exemption from the evidentiary code, or in some instances, hearsay exceptions that are available in front of grand jury. Again, 42 states have some sort of exception or their rules don't apply. In 8 states, the rules of evidence do apply. And finally, this slide indicates just those states that are actively engaged in using grand jury. And when I say actively engaged, notice that Idaho's up there. And as we heard earlier in the testimony, only maybe 10 or 15% of the cases in Idaho are actually presented to a grand jury. But we wanted to err on the side of a conservative presentation here. And so we have really highlighted states that really, if there's any regular practice, use grand jury. They're listed here. Those states that are cross-hatched on here are states that do not apply the rules of evidence to grand jury. The states that are in bright yellow are the states that do apply the rules of evidence to grand jury. So again, I wanted to give you a basic overview of how grand jury works in the United States, and hope as you move forward with a policy decision here that we take a very close look at what the reasons are that those states that don't use the rules of evidence, why are they not using the rules of evidence? And those states that do use the rules of evidence, why do they use them, and what are the impacts on the communities that are involved in the criminal justice system? So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. If there aren't any questions, yeah.
Kevin, I'm going to hold off on questions. What I want to do is give Lisa an opportunity to testify. She's up from Lane County. It looks like, based on timing and stuff, we're going to be shutting down, and so we're going to have to continue tomorrow. Unless members, you know, want to stay a little bit longer, but I have a rule from the president's office that I should be shutting down in 30 seconds. We're going to split. We're going to not worry about the 30 seconds, but we want to make certain Lisa has an opportunity.
Chair Przanski, I mostly brought Lisa here if there were any questions about the practice of grand jury. She's a practitioner from Idaho that has moved here, so she is mostly here just to answer any questions if there are questions to that.
All right. So, Walt, I know you can be here. So I guess I'm going to go ahead and open it up for questions if we have questions right now as to we've heard testimony regarding how the grand jury process works, proceedings and stuff like that. So if there's questions about that, if not, I'd like to go ahead and continue to take testimony so we can clear as many people through this process. Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kevin, I just want to have a better understanding of, you know, the maps that you've showed us. So why exactly is the question of whether or not the rules of evidence are in play, how is that relevant to our decision whether or not to go forward with recordation? I mean, that's the focus of our decision here today.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer is that recording the grand jury here, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the process of recording the grand jury will, in fact, cause a shift in the practice in Oregon, and that's something that you'll hear from District Attorney Beglau. And what we would like you to consider is what's the impact likely to be on victims and witnesses. And if the victims and witnesses are not required to be in front of the grand jury and their statements aren't recorded, they then, of course, won't be turned over to the defense. And so in terms of the execution of the grand jury and the recordation, that is a change in practice that will have or potentially have an impact on victims. That's why we think it should be part of the discussion.
All right, Senator Lithicum.
Follow-up. The yellow and the hatched are labeled the gray.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lithicum, the gray are states that really do not practice grand jury. They either use preliminary hearings to move cases forward towards an indictment, or they do not have a requirement for grand jury or preliminary hearing, and they can just move those cases directly in front of a judge.
Excuse me. You just said the gray cases or states represent that?
Except for Oregon.
Yeah, I was going to say,
yes.
Put a big exception.
I will change that. And
thank
again,
you very much.
Note that these are states that actively record. I should make that point here. So
okay.
These are states that actively record.
All right. So at this point, I'll take a couple more minutes of testimony before I have to let members go to do their thing at 10. So, Walt, did you want to put something onto the record this time?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglau. I serve as the District Attorney of Marin County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association this morning. I've sat through all the testimony, and I'm very appreciative and respectful of the different perspectives we've heard from today. I think this is a very important dialogue for Oregon and its justice system. Let me get right to two issues. At the gateway of our justice system, we could not place a higher premium on recording accuracy and then ultimately the retention and the retrieval of that information for the appropriate parties. The gold standard is court reporting. I've been in this very room over decades making that statement to this committee. And we know from those processes they're very expensive. Just as expensive or in terms of the infrastructure that you need to design in the Oregon courtrooms is a recording process. I'm very respectful of the gentleman from Alaska, but we're not Alaska. We run grand jury 5 days a week in Marin County all day, and sometimes we're running two. If we've got a homicide, we need the space, capacity, and FTE to manage that in a very effective way. Multnomah County, I'm guessing, is as big as the population of Alaska. I'm just throwing that out there. So any recording mechanism must genuinely address the imperative of accuracy and a meaning assessment of those costs for the counties to be able to manage that. Our counties are so different with such different infrastructure right now to be able to navigate this as this would roll out. That's my top priority. We've mentioned preliminary hearing here. I've never conducted one. There's probably very few in this room that have. What I know is what I know from statute. But looking at that, it does have an open court process so that the elements of greater transparency can occur, and we understand that's part of our objective. The burden of proof is probable cause, which is the very same it is for arresting an individual for a crime. It's subject to judicial scrutiny. We have the existing courtrooms and infrastructure to do that. And in that statute, the court is empowered to look for efficiencies and look at the vulnerabilities of witnesses and victims and expand the hearsay potential in those things. And I'm confident courts would do that. So my point is, one conclusion, that courts and DAs together, with the prospect of an underfunded, potentially error-prone system that doesn't have the protections for victims that we have shared here in our written testimony and today with Kevin, preliminary hearing would be a viable option. And they would be making those qualitative decisions and assessing their victims. And so we want to be real mindful of that as we look at the infrastructure for doing this. Final note on victims. We've talked a lot about impacts to DAs and defense attorneys today. We should be thinking about impact to victims as well as they go through multiple scrutiny and different areas. I looked at the provision. It seems very narrow around the exception for under the age of 18. The way I read the statute now in 496, that if someone, a child at 12, decided not to disclose until she was 18 about a horrible crime, would have to come in a grand jury. Why are we making that distinction? She's experienced an abusive situation. We ought to take her or him at face value for the traumatization they've had. So those are my comments today. Again, as Mr. Neely has stated, the district attorneys support grand jury recordation with appropriate safeguards and the appropriate investment in the infrastructure.
All right, thank you. So any quick questions?
I have a quick question. Kevin, in your research, did you look at the cost of recordation in those other states?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Dimbrough, we have not undergone a serious evaluation of what the cost is. Many states have been recording truly, probably since Senator Carter first introduced this legislation.
Okay. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, one thing I'm struggling with is right now somebody's sitting at a laptop or possibly writing something down handwritten. Why jump to we have to have a professional instead of just having somebody press a button while they're sitting in there? Wouldn't that be an improvement over just handwritten notes or typed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, what our research has shown us is that every state that records does use some level of professional recording equipment. I'm not telling you that every state has a judge or a judicial clerk that's pushing the yes or the start and stop button on that. But again, by now, this is technical. It is technical. There are pieces in even in 496 of the testimony that I should say there are pieces of the grand jury proceeding that can and cannot be recorded. And our position is that it does require and it ought to be professionalized. Again, the answer to your question is, can someone come in and hit the start and stop button on a recording device? The answer is yes.
So
go ahead.
Yes.
And wouldn't jumping to preliminary hearings be even more detrimental to a victim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, that's potential. That's the qualitative decision that we'd be making. But again, if I have to balance against a grand jury process that I don't think is effectively funded and potentially prone to error, you mentioned the fact that recording system, there's always the human element, there's the mechanical element. Literally, we've had cases reversed, serious cases reversed, based on a failure of some person to push a button or properly record. So I worry about those safeguards. So that's the balancing that we do. I'm not saying that I'm going to go to preliminary hearing because we're going to be looking at the qualitative impact on victims, but it is a resource that exists right now in statute, and we'd want to consider it.
All right, I'm going to conclude the testimony for today. What I want to do is put on the record, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 496, Senate Bill 505 till tomorrow to continue taking testimony. Who I have listed now are the ones that will be able to give testimony tomorrow based on their attendance today. Michael Savaggio, Steve Dole, Aaron Olson, Dave Factor, Patrick Singh, Doug Barber. Is there anyone that's name I just didn't read out that's here today that wants to give testimony on one of those two bills so we can record it? Oh, sorry, Kimberly. Yes, I'm sorry. You're on the list. I forgot. Didn't get that on. All right, with that, we're going to adjourn for the day. We will be back here tomorrow at 8 o'clock carrying over these two bills for the for the remainder of the testimony. Thank everyone for being here. Sorry we just ran out of time and couldn't get everyone's testimony in today. For that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.